Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Welcome to the series of podcasts conducted by SBGAN, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely. Well, here I am, such as I am, Dr. Alex Nicely, although it always surprises me to hear myself referred to in those terms. Most especially today, because I'm not the one on whom attention should be focused, not today. Instead, we're lucky, really lucky to have with us today Dr. Alexandra Papadopoulou, who is, and you must correct me right here and now if I get this wrong, who is at the University of Athens, Children's Hospital, Hagia Sophia, Department of Pediatrics, the first Department of Pediatrics, Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology, the chief and leader. She has a particular interest in eosinophilic disorders of the gastrointestinal tract. We all know about eosinophilic esophagitis. That's our bread and butter, at least speaking as a histopathologist who's seen a lot of esophageal biopsies. But more important than that, or more interestingly perhaps than that, are disorders that are characterized by mucositis and deeper inflammation with the eosinophilia of the stomach and of the small bowel. Eosinophilic gastritis, eosinophilic duodenitis, that reflect a sort of system-wide dysregulation of the immune response. As we were chatting in the lead up to beginning the recording process, I commented, you know, these are so rare. I can't remember seeing more than a few in a decades-long career in pediatric pathology. And she said, and this is wisdom, she said, there are two reasons why something can be rare. First is, it's rare. And the second is because you don't know how to recognize it when it's on the microscope stage staring up at you through the objective. And I have to admit, I might not be the best at recognizing eosinophilic gastritis, even when it's presented to me as a histopathology sample. In order to address problems associated with this class of disorders, SBGAN and NASBGAN have put together a task force to address diagnosis, classification, let's just say classification, both clinical and histopathologic, recognition, and treatment, as well as, of course, making certain that the basic abnormalities in pathophysiology can be explored, better understood, and better corrected. And it's about the recommendations of that task force, that interest group, and about how she sees work in this field developing, that we're lucky enough to have Dr. Papadopoulou here with us. Alexandra, cousin by name, Alex and Alexandra, welcome.
Thank you, Alex, for inviting me. It is my pleasure to discuss all these interesting things and hot topics
with you. Yes.
I'll tell you what. 10 years ago, we were discussing the topic of eosinophilic esophagitis. And at that time, we were thinking that EOE is rare. What happened afterwards? People started to recognize the disease, started to recognize the symptoms. We had guidelines from SBGAN, from NASBGAN, from a task force among pediatric and adult gastroenterologists and all the other specialists who had an interest in this. And we published guides, how to guide clinicians in their daily practice. What happened afterwards? You see a few thousand publications accumulated now about EOE. People do recognize it. We have tools how to recognize, how to classify endoscopy and histological findings. We have everything. What happens with the GIDS beyond UE. We start from zero. Why? First, clinicians and pathologists do not have a common language. How to name these diseases?
I think you're absolutely right there. We're talking past each other, aren't we?
Exactly. Second, pathologists.
Do not know
how to evaluate eosinophilic inflammation and how to report it.
Okay, that's fair. Harsh, but fair.
Third, after 15 years, we know exactly that the number, the threshold of eosinophils in the esophagus in order to be considered pathological is at least 15 per hyperophilic.
Right.
Here, we don't know how many eosinophils in the different segments of the GI tract are too many.
Understood.
We had to find out. So, ESPGAN and ASPGAN combined forces, invited people with different expertise, areas of expertise, pediatric gastroenterologists, adult gastroenterologists, pathologists, immunologists, and all of them sit down, reviewed the literature. How many do you think we found? A few hundred literatures.
Get out of here, a few hundred?
Case reports and observational studies.
Oh, I've been missing an awful lot.
Exactly. What is the other problem? We don't have the proper coding for each of these diseases. So how can we know the exact incidence and prevalence of these diseases if we don't have the code for each of the diseases? So these diseases are not so rare. They are rare, but not
that rare. Gotcha.
They present with atypical symptoms.
Go on.
If the stomach, for example, is involved in the eosinophilic inflammatory process, then the symptoms are like abdominal pain, epigastric pain, vomiting, early satiety, iron deficiency anemia, protein loss, hypoalbuminemia, bleeding, maybe hematemesis, maybe melena. If the small intestine is involved, not the whole layer, but the mucosa, the symptoms are completely different from those symptoms when the deeper lower layer of the GI wall is involved, is impaired by the eosinophilic inflammation. So if the small intestine is involved, the mucosa of the small intestine, that you may have the symptoms that were mentioned before, plus diarrhea. If the colon, you may have dysgeusia, constipation or hematochezia, tenesmus. These are atypical symptoms. Several diseases may present with these symptoms.
Yes, nonspecific.
And the most important, if the deeper layer, the muscular layer, is involved, you know how do these diseases present in infants? They mimic pyloric stenosis.
Well, that makes sense. If there's inflammation that paralyzes the normal function of the pylorus?
Not exactly, but there is eosinophilic infiltration, and this way increases the thickness of the antrum and causes outlet obstruction.
You know, but Alexandra, allow me to defend myself and my colleagues. We so seldom receive full thickness biopsies of the intestinal tract.
You don't need. In this case, when the condition mimics pyloric stenosis, what you have to do is to ask the radiologist who performs the ultrasound to look at the thickness of the antrum. They do not look at this. They look at the thickness only of the pylorus.
Of course.
So if you find pathologically increased thickness of the antrum, you may, and if you see also peripheral eosinophilia, mild peripheral eosinophilia, you think about eosinophilic gastritis.
You should think
pyloric stenosis never affects the thickness of the antrum, only the thickness of the pylorus. So it is important to know about the disease, to ask these questions and to pay attention to these details that make the difference. What should you do then? You should call your friend, who is a pediatric gastroenterologist, to put down a scope to perform an upper endoscopy, take mucosal biopsies.
Yes.
And look under the microscope whether there is eosinophilic inflammation. Mm-hmm. And if there is, then you make the correct diagnosis of eosinophilic gastritis, causing outlet obstruction, mimicking pyloric stenosis. And this child does not need a surgery. This child does need a specific treatment of eosinophilic esophagitis, and the problem will resolve. Second, it is not...
I'm going through mea culpa, mea culpa.
Mea culpa, mea culpa, okay. So when the muscular layer, the deeper layer of the small intestine is involved, what you can see? You can see either full obstruction or pseudo-obstruction.
Pseudo-obstruction.
Pseudo-obstruction. Because the eosinophils go down to the muscular ganglia, the muscular fibers. They trap the ganglia and they cause
dysmotility.
Exactly. Exactly. Uh-huh. We have children. People do not recognize them. If they do not know, how can you recognize something?
If you don't know, you won't see.
Exactly. How can you recognize something that you don't know, you don't understand? Next problem.
Many problems.
Next problem, pathologists. Pathologists do not have a common language.
Oh, I'm feeling very seen at this moment. Go on.
Do you know that even in the same lab, pathology lab, the microscopes that are used have different sizes of high power fields?
I know that. It's never been the case where I've worked, but I've heard of it. I deplore it.
We carried a study with my center, with Rome and Madrid, major pediatric gastroenterology centers. And what we did?
What did you do?
We looked back to all of the biopsies of the children who had over the last several years upper GI endoscopy or lower endoscopy for functional symptoms, who had an extensive examination, and it turned out that they did not have any organic disease. We asked our pathologists, three pathologists, to review all the biopsies.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
I'm all ears.
The microscopes had different sizes of high power field.
That makes it easier or harder to find 15.
So if you say that 15 is the cutoff, if you have a smaller high power field, the maximum number is much lower.
Yes.
If you have bigger, larger, the maximum is higher, much higher. So what we found, we cannot, make strict conclusions from the literature if they do not announce, if they do not indicate the size of their high power fields.
Absolutely.
And you never see that in only very, very, very few publications. So what we suggested in our guidelines to all pathologists all over the world is, in order to have a common language, they should report the numbers of eosinophils per a standardized high power field, which we suggested it is 0.27 square millimeters.
Understood.
Or even better, report the number of eosinophils per square millimeter, which is objective.
Completely. That is entirely objective. Yes.
So only this way, the pathologists will have, a common language, and everybody or the researchers will be able to have homogenized groups and perform research that will have something to
meaningful.
Say.
Meaningful. Yes.
Otherwise, it's meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
The pathologists also did not recognize how to evaluate other signs of eosinophilic inflammation. Which also play a role. The finding of eosinophilic degranulation.
Evidence of loose granules in the tissues, yes.
Exactly. Basal membrane fibrosis.
Right.
Abscesses, eosinophilic abscesses.
They didn't overlook those.
Eosinophilic infiltration of the glands, of the subepithelial layers.
Yes,
eosinophilic infiltration of the muscular layer, which should not be there.
Eosinophils should not be there. Yeah.
And then the other problem, I'm talking only about problems, but we all solved with our guidelines. So the other problem is, what is the normal and what is the abnormal? What we did is we carried out the same study as we did with Madrid and Rome, the same study while we were reviewing the literature over the last 2.5 years. We carried out the same study in Liverpool, Tel Aviv, and in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And we used the data also from a small study carried out in Porto. One person from the University of Tel Aviv, with his statistician, took the raw data of all those children mm-hmm. who did not have an organic disease.
Right.
And they calculated, they found out what is normal, mm-hmm. the upper lower of normal, what is abnormal. Those raw data were discussed within a histology group among the authors.
Yes.
Margaret Collins.
Maggie Collins. Yes, I know Maggie.
Oh, yes, from US. Fatima Carneiro mm-hmm. from Europe were leading this group. So there were extensive discussions how to evaluate all things, how to evaluate the findings from our studies, the literature, and they came to a consensus what should be indicated as normal and what is mm-hmm. should be indicated mm-hmm. as abnormal. And the abnormal numbers were different. The thresholds were different in different segments of the GI tract.
Yes, I can
different
believe that.
Normal peak number of eosinophils you see in the stomach, bigger
than
the duodenum, bigger in the ileum, in the cecum, in the ascending column, and then they go down. They go up to transverse column, and from the transverse column and down,
onwards they go down.
And we have mm-hmm. numbers.
Yeah.
At least 30 in the stomach, at least 50 in the duodenum, at least 70 in the ileum, at least 100. In the transverse colon and so on. So we give in these guidelines a guide to the pathologist how to report and how to assess first and how to report.
Well, it sounds as if you've put things onto a very, very useful and stable platform from which to carry forward. Alexandra, our engineer, Mr. Schuster, has just signaled to me, we've run out of time. How can this be? We were having a painful experience, but I think a growthful one. I've taken away from this information that I can use and hope to use, but we have to stop. We have to ask you now for a song with which to conclude this aspect of our presentation. Have you found one for us?
Yeah, maybe it is the Gioconda smile of our Manos Hadzidakis. Manos Hadzidakis is one of my favorite.
Wonderful. If you like it, that's reason enough to share it with our friends.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
I quite like that. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, well, for setting me straight and for sharing what this working group has done for us all. January number of this year's JPGN, folks. Go read it.
Thank you very much, Alex.
It's been a treat. Bye-bye.